This morning, as we see this week is the end of 2020, we are departing from our regular Sunday morning schedule to take some time to reflect. To reflect not so much on the general events of this year, which, you know, you can use a lot of different adjectives to describe, but to think about particular individuals. And these individuals that we're going to focus on, these Torah personalities, these are not the only great losses that we consider, reflect on during this time. First of all, there are many people who are still suffering and struggling right now. There are people who had personal losses, family losses. But when we think of our perspective on Torah, on Yiddishkeit, and on life, we need to consider Am Yisrael, the Jewish people. We identify ourselves not just as individuals, but as members of Klal Yisrael, members of Knesset Yisrael, members of Am Yisrael. And in that respect, this year, Am Yisrael has seen several notable, painful losses. Some of them, many of them, are related to the COVID virus, to the coronavirus pandemic. Some of them, just that was the time the Ribbono Shel Olam chose. But a tekufa like this, in which there is so much struggle, so much suffering, so much difficulty, to be highlighted by the Mises Tzaddikim, the loss of specific Torah personalities, requires that we take a pause to recognize, just even for a few moments, who were these individuals and how significant their impact was on the Jewish world. As part of this, it reminds us to realize that we all, each one of us, needs to have heroes, needs to have individuals, people who we look to for inspiration. And every door v'dorshav, every generation has those individuals that we can look to as people to be inspired by, to look up to. And when we have a period like this, a tekufa like this, where we lose lights, sparks, brilliant sources of inspiration for so many people across the spectrum, we need to remind ourselves that even though those beacons of inspiration are gone, as the Gemara says in Brachos, Tzaddikim, their role is even stronger, their neshamas have a greater influence after they're gone. But B, so we can still connect to them and be inspired by them, but B, to make sure that we still have, and we are searching for, Rabbeim, teachers, role models who can inspire us. We as a community and we as individuals, we must have, in every generation, we must have our Gedolei Torah. We must have the people who we look to as the torchbearers of our Mesorah, as the arbiters of our moral conscience, of halachic issues, of guidance. We need to have those. So by spending this morning and reflecting on these individuals, it reminds us, A, of their loss, and B, of the significance that we need to place on having Torah personalities in our lives, in Gedolei Torah. And whether that, you know, it's going to mean different things for different people. Whether that means calling such a person on the phone, or listening to a shir that they give, or reading something that they wrote. So that will apply to the people who we're going to mention today, but also to the modern day Gedolei Torah that we still have and we need to seek out and connect with. It was interesting in preparing and researching and connecting, there was a great sense I felt of emotion in thinking about specifically certain personalities that we're going to mention today, who had actually a profound and meaningful impact on my life, on my Torah development, and my thinking. And I hope that you will also find ways to connect to these individuals on an emotional level, not just on some cerebral cognitive appreciation. It was also interesting that even though the personalities that we're going to mention today, and we're obviously not going to do any of them justice, even though in many respects they were so distinct, which we're going to try to capture to make sure that they're not coming across even as the same, which they were not at all the same, and they were so different, and yet there were certain things that were in common, at least among many of them, which is also interesting. I feel a little bit bad because there is so much to say. We could devote an entire morning and then some and then weeks to each one of these individuals, but we will suffice with just a few minutes during this brief survey, this overview, just to understand and be familiar with their name, who they were, and what, at least on one level, what one message is that we could take away from them. What's one message of Sifsos of Dovavos Bekever that they taught us in their lifetime that we can take away and apply in our lives? It's not just that these individuals were diverse. They were diverse personally, but they also reflected and represented different approaches to life. And they're also people. They're human beings. And that means that nobody is perfect. And it's not just that I'm not going to present a comprehensive portrait of any of these individuals. I'm not saying that everything that each person here wrote or said or did over the course of their lifetime was perfect, or anyone will agree with all or every statement that they made, or Torah that they taught, or approach that they suggested, or stand that they took. But in their totality, they represented a positive force of good, and they were Torah giants, major Torah personalities. And these Masoras, when we look at them, these different perspectives, they actually complement each other. And it's important for us to learn from all of them. There are going to be people who we're going to meet today who not only have you never heard of, but they would have never come across your desk as part of the pantheon of Torah giants, because they're from a different Torah community. Just like in the parashas we're reading about how Yaakov had 12 Shvatim, 12 sons, who had a different approach to life, to Avodas Hashem. So there are different Gaonim, different Gedolim, different Tzadikim, and they have different approaches, different Masoras. But what we need to understand is that they each have something to contribute to our Masorah as well. Many of us in this virtual room, we have a particular Masorah. We have a particular tradition, a spiritual tradition, a Ruchniyistika tradition, a particular Hashkafas Achayim. But that Hashkafas Achayim is enriched, but it's not just enriched. It is essential for it to reflect an understanding of the greatest and broadest perspectives that exist in the general Torah community. So these different personalities should and hopefully will inspire us to grow as a community, to take the best of what is out there across the spectrum, which is something that Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Zecher Tzadik V'Kadosh L'Vracha, was want to emphasize. So we're going to mention this morning, we're going to mention 10 individuals, 10 men, 10 figures, who passed away in the past year. And this is not to suggest that these are the only 10 major Torah personalities. There are other Torah personalities who left us this year, and there are lots of significant women, but I'm just choosing 10 people who I think, when you take them in totality, can teach us 10 important lessons. Ve'idach Zilgamor, there are probably many others from whom we can learn. And I'll ask this Hisnatzlos HaMachaber at the outset that we only chose these 10. And obviously there are many more to learn from. Let's begin, as we are right now in Chicago, with a Chicago connection, with one significant Torah personality who left us this year, an American giant in the Torah community, the Novominsker Rebbe, Rav Yaakov Perlau, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. Novominsker was, although he was from New York, his father was the previous Novominsker Rebbe, but he had a strong Chicago connection, as many of you know, as he was married to the daughter of the previous Zidichover Rebbe, so he has several family connections here in the Eichenstein family. And not only that, he served as a Rebbe for 17 years in the Fasman Yeshiva High School. So I wonder even if some of the people in this group, they or their children, were students of the Novominsker when he was here in Chicago as a Rebbe in Fasim Yeshiva High School. And he was known for his love and his warmth of his Talmidim, his connection that he built with his Talmidim. After that, of course, he moved back to New York. He was a Rosh Yeshiva in the Breuer's Yeshiva in Washington Heights for a while before moving to Brooklyn after his father's passing, when he established his own yeshiva and he set up the Beis Medrash that he had. When he was here, he was very influential among the Talmidim. Rabbi Beryl Wein, shall live and be well, another notable Chicagoan, he noted that even though at those times he was not yet the Novominsker Rebbe, he nevertheless always exemplified to me the essence of a Rebbe in the way he cared for all Jews and his unbounded optimism and good cheer. There was no student to whom he could not relate, and one felt both intimate and awed in his presence at the same time. Rav Avram Friedman, shalit to the current Rosh Yeshiva in HTC, in Beis Medrash LaTorah, was a student of his, was a high school boy learning in his shir. And at one point he had to miss yeshiva because his mother wasn't doing well, so he went with a group of his friends to the hospital to donate blood. The Rebbe didn't just give him permission. The Novominsker showed up to the hospital, rolled up the sleeves of his rekel, his bekesha, to give blood also. The Rebbe had, as is appropriate for a Chassidish Rebbe, something we can take away, had a tremendous Ahavas Yisrael. One of the messages that he taught and lived was to love Jews. There is a beautiful appreciation of the Novominsker Rebbe, authored by Susanna Heschel, of all places. Susanna Heschel, the professor at Dartmouth College in New Hampshire, the daughter of the late Rabbi Avram Yeshua A.J. Heschel, obviously has a very different religious tradition than the Novominsker, but was a distant cousin of his, and wrote an appreciation in Tablet magazine, which is suffused with warmth and this understanding of how the Rebbe brought Ahavas Yisrael and an understanding of different places that really was expressed in the biography of his different places where he lived and worked and taught. And this Ahava, this love, comes across in the last public statement that the Rebbe made. As you know, the Rebbe was a member of the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah of the Agudas Yisrael of America. He was a major spokesman of the Aguda, and for decades he delivered shiurim and talks and speeches, and he was a brilliant orator and great writer. So he authored a letter. And I want to share with you just a little bit of this letter because it's pertinent to how we're experiencing unfortunately, the current pandemic, and it reinforces the idea, the message that we could take from the Rebbe of love Jews. Love Jews. And the structure that I'd like to pursue today, as you see now, is we're going to give just a tiny bit of background about every person, the message, a message that we can take from them, a little maisa, a little story about them, and something from their Torah, from their writing that we can take away with us. So I'm going to share my screen now. So you can see, this is the open letter. It's called Michtav Bracha, an open letter to the Jewish people, a letter of blessing that was authored right before Pesach. It was published actually only hours before the passing of the Novominsker, and the Novominsker himself wrote the bulk of this letter. It was tweaked afterwards by the Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah. You see, it's signed Moetzes Gedolei HaTorah by America. Achim Ahuvim, beloved brothers, Reim Yekarim, dear friends, Yitzav Hashem Itchem Es HaBracha L'Orech Yom Tovim. The Rebbe opens the letter with this emphasis on beloved Jews, loving Jews. And he starts the letter with the first paragraph that we are standing, the entire Jewish community and the entire world, right before Pesach, before we left Egypt, which was, of course, this was March 2020, just at the outset of the outbreak of the pandemic, which took place right around Purim time. And we have, of course, toward the end, but you see it about here on the fourth paragraph, of course, Chayav Kol Echad Litzayis La'Oros HaMemshala, we're obligated to follow, the Rebbe says, the Moetza says, we are obligated to follow the directives of the government, ulishmo aladrishas harofim hamumchim, and to listen to the experts, the doctors, and not chalila to fall in that. So he's emphasizing the importance of following the medical guidance. But the previous paragraph is a little bit of chizuk. Hine achim ahuvim, beloved brothers, dafka be'esuv ona zos, this time, in this tkufa, dafka achshav, specifically now, hachova mutelas aleinu, it is obligatory, it is incumbent upon us, we are required, leschazi kulonu ki ish echad b'lev echad, to gather, to strengthen ourselves as one, ulahachris b'nafshosenu emunas, omein ki kulonu yotzim ze'ata kamo b'chol dovedar. That even though we may feel that we are trapped in the meitzar, in the straits of Egypt, of the proverbial Egypt, trapped, quarantined by the pandemic, we have to believe and feel internally that we have a chayrus, a freedom. Chayrus hanefesh, freedom of spirit, l'toru l'mitzvos, to connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, l'toru l'mitzvos. Chayrus shal kavod shamayim gemilas chasadim, all of the aspects of chayrus that we can draw upon, even if and when, rachmana litzlan, we are in quarantine, when we're distant from each other. And it comes, this mechtav of chizuk, comes from a man who is literally in his last hours of life with that regish, that feeling of loving Jews, of feeling that sense of ahava to all of us, and that we can take that and teach it forward and live it in our own lives. Yehi zichro baruch. The next person who some of you may have met, some of you knew, I have a personal family connection because my father-in-law, Shalom Be Well, was a young man, a boy growing up in Toronto to parents who came after the destruction of Europe and began to rebuild their lives in Toronto. The Rav of their community in Toronto for quite a few years was a young, brilliant mind who had previously served as a rabbi in Texas for a brief period of time, in Charleston, South Carolina, and then in Toronto before moving to England and ultimately to Eretz Yisrael, where he was invited to be the Rosh Yeshiva, which is where he spent his last decades, as the Yeshiva of Birkat Moshe, at the head of the Yeshiva called Birkat Moshe in Male Adumim. And that was Rav Nachum Eliezer Rabinovich, Zecher Tzadik Levracha. Rav Rabinovich was not just a community Rav, he was also a Rosh Yeshiva. He wasn't just a tremendous Talmud Chacham, an expert in Rambam, which is where his passion was, which is where he published an entire commentary on all of the Rambam called Yad Pshuta. The outstretched hand comes also from the word Pshat and Pashut, the simple understanding, how to understand the Rambam. And Yad, Yud, Dalid, 14, is the number of books in the Rambam's magnum opus that he was working on to explain to all of us, called Yad Pshuta's 14 books. That's Rabbi Rabinovich's great work. And then in recent years, several other volumes have been published, Siach Nochem and others. Rav Rabinovich also had a PhD in mathematics and statistics from the University of Toronto. He was a broad scholar and thinker and a towering Talmud Chacham. He was also incredibly sensitive to individuals. One of the a Talmud of his, who was a Rav in Israel, described the following story that appeared in several places after his passing. This Rav, his name is Rabbi Reif. Rabbi Reif describes the following story, that even though Rav Rabinovich was very punctilious about being on time for anything, he never kept anybody waiting, and he was always punctilious about his schedule. He would even get to shul a few minutes early just to make sure to be on time for davening. However, a couple of years ago, when he was still well, he was asked to officiate at a wedding. But unfortunately, because of a scheduling mix-up, which, you know, it happens from time to time, it turns out that the Kala was only able to immerse in the mikveh on the actual night of her wedding, which would obviously create a tremendous amount of tension and potential embarrassment for this Kala, because now the chuppah is going to have to start later than it had been planned, and there was a lot of anxiety around this Kala. and Rav Rabinovich was going to be the Masada Kedushin. And when he was asked about this, when he heard about this, what they should do, he said, don't worry, I'll get to the wedding late. The people will be upset at me, but at least it will spare this Kala from having the embarrassment of people knowing that she has to go to the mikvah the night of her wedding when everyone's waiting. And so it was. He arrived over an hour late to this wedding, and Rabbi Reif, the one who told the story, he remembers the grumblings and the whispers of the people at the wedding. Especially, you can imagine, Israeli weddings, they're also not exactly, they're not so, you know, formal. So to stand around, wait for the rabbi for over an hour, it's like, you know, they're ready, they're running down the chuppah. It's not, you know, in America, maybe it takes an hour and a half for the chuppah. In Israel, everybody dances. The whole preparation for the chuppah takes 3 minutes. But people were whispering how late it was, but he didn't mind. Because if he could do something, even if it was in his own cheshbon, to save the busha of somebody else, that was worth it. So Rabbi Yitzi Sprung, who is a close friend of mine, assistant rabbi in Or Torah and a graduate of our Kolol, he introduced me to the thought and the personality of Rabbi Rabinovich from a learning side. I had heard about him many times from my father-in-law, many stories from his youth about what a tremendous personality he was, and we'll talk about another student of his in a few moments. But Rabbi Sprung, he introduced me to the thought of Rabbi Rabinovich because Rabbi Sprung studied in Birkat Moshe. So as I was preparing, I said to him, so how would you think about one message that Rav Rabinovich shared with his Talmidim? What was an important idea? And he pointed me to the notion, and what we can call it as, take responsibility. The centrality of Bechira Chafshis, of free choice, in Rav Rabinovich's writings, which, by the way, there was a beautiful appreciation by one of his Talmidim. I think it was published in Lair House. I'm happy to share some of these afterwards, but you could just Google Rabbi Nachum Rabinovich and free will. There are a bunch of essays that he wrote where this became a central motif, a seminal concept that he kept coming back to in terms of understanding our role in the world being rooted in Bechira Chafshis. That we have free choice and we have to own our destiny and take responsibility for ourselves. Ad kedei kach, that he has the following fascinating, incredible insight in his psicha, in his introduction, his mavo lehilchos tshuva. We mentioned the outset that he wrote a commentary on the entire 14 books of the Rambam and the Yad Pshuta. So in the introduction to the laws of tshuva, he writes the following. So I'm reading it to you. Ba'akdamasa l'mishnah Torah. The first of the books of the 14 of the Rambam is called Sefer Mada, the Book of the Knowledge. And the Rambam gave you klolim, general principles. And he says, quote, the Rambam says, Sefer Rishon, the first book, which is what we call Sefer Hamada. Echlobo, the Rambam says, I'm going to include in it kol mitzvah shem ikar hadas mosh, das mosh rabbeinu alav shalom. I'm going to include all the fundamentals of Yiddishkeit. Vitzarecha adam leida usam tchila sakol. Person has to know them in their entirety. Kagon. For example, Yichud Hashem Baruch Hu, the unity of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the Isuri Avodah Zarah, the prohibition against idol worship, etc. The Karasi, V'Shem Zeh, Sefer Hamada, the Rambam says, I call this book the Book of the Knowledge. Now, what are the principles of the Rambam? They are, of course, the 13 Ikarim, the 13 basic principles of Emuna, of faith, of belief, of principles. Kiminyan, they are following the word Echad. Echad is the gematria of 13. So the Rambam, in his commentary on the Mishnayos, which he wrote when he was a teenager in the beginning of the last parak in Sanhedrin, gives you exactly how these 13 are enumerated. And so the Rambam, of course, fleshes them out in Hilchos Yesodei HaTorah. However, Rav Rabinovich adds, Mibchina Hegyonis, from the perspective of logic, Od ikar yeshno hakodem lekulam. There is one fundamental principle that precedes all of the ikarim of the Rambam. What we learn from the Rambam's words himself. Vehi vehu hayesod. That is the principle asher bilado. That without it, how you quote betelim hatzivui vaasara toraniim. We would actually not have any Judaism. Judaism as a religion, as a way of life, as halakha, expectations, things that we do and don't do, all of the Torah's injunctions, restrictions, everything, it wouldn't exist. The Rambam's quote from Pirush HaMishnayos in Pirkei Avos called Shmona Prakim. That's what we call it. And what does the Rambam write in Hilchos Tshuva? It's not coincidental, Rav Rabinovich would tell you, of course, that it's smack right in the middle of Hilchos Tshuva and Parakei. Quote, V'dovar ze ikar godolu v'o omor hator v'amitzvah. And what is that? This is the major principle, what he writes in the Pirush HaMishnayos. Ha'emes she'em bo safek. The truth which has no doubt. Shekol ma'ase ha'adam. All of the actions of man. Misurim biyado. They're in our hands. Imratza ose vimratza lo yase. If you want or if you don't want. You can do or you cannot do. Lolo hechreach. There is no coercion, velo kfia, and no imposition, olav bekach. Turns out, he says, Nimtza, turns out, Mispar kol hayesodos arba a'asar. Turns out that there are actually 14 fundamentals of faith. Ukenegdom, says Rav Rabinovich, Sifrei Mishneh Torah heim yudalad. There are also 14 books in the Mishneh Torah. We want to think about how we relate to this world, how we lead our lives. It's understanding that the Yesod HaKol is that we have choices. And it's up to us to take responsibility for our life. Our moral choices, they're ours, and we need to own them. Own our own choices. The centrality of Bechira Chavshis. Take responsibility. A teaching, a fundamental of Rav Rabinovich. Yizichro Baruch. You know who was a Talmud Vosik, one of the closest students of Rav Nachum Rabinovich? The next person we're going to mention today, none other than Rabbi Yaakov Tzvi, Lord Jonathan Sacks, Zichrono Levracha. Rabbi Sacks, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, was employed by and actually delivered, if we had all day and all night, I would share with you, he has a magnificent, in the office of the Chief Rabbi's website, he has a magnificent tribute, a video tribute to his Rebbe, the man who he considered his own Rebbe, Rabbi Nachum Rabinovich, Zichrono Levracha. And it's interesting to me, because one of the fundamentals of Rabbi Sacks' thought, one of his ekronos in teachings that we have learned from him, is the idea of personal responsibility. And I wonder if this idea, I don't know enough Rabbi Sacks, I don't know enough anything, but I wonder if this idea actually is somehow connected to his interactions with Rav Rabinovich, who emphasized the role of free choice, of Bechira Chavshis. And as part sound quality change. I hope it's still working out. So actually there was a festschrift published in honor of Rabbi Sacks. And what was it called? It was called Radical Responsibility. Because Rabbi Sacks challenges us to take responsibility for our lives as well, but not just as individuals. Not just that we have Bechira Chavshis in our individual lives, in our personal lives, in our tiny little sviva, but to become leaders, to be a leader, to be a leader. And this is what Rabbi Sacks develops in a series of shurim of teachings on Chumash, which is this book, I don't know if you could see it, Lessons in Leadership, the importance of being a leader in the teachings of Rabbi Sacks. Now, many of you know that Rabbi Sacks himself encountered some great leaders. One of the stories that he tells, and if you want to watch him, he's going to tell it so much better than I will, but you can Google Rabbi Posner, one of our beautiful, wonderful Chabad shluchim here in Skokie, Rabbi Posner Sr., Rabbi Yossi Posner. So he shared with me a clip of the talk that Rabbi Sacks gave to the Kinnah Shluchim to describe Rabbi Sacks' meeting with the Lubavitcher Rebbe. Rabbi Sacks, after the Six-Day War, describes in the introduction to this book a maisa that he's told many times. The maisa was how, after the Six-Day War, he was kind of struggling and wondering. He was in university, and he had some time, so he decided he was going to travel to America, because in his inquiries, he kept hearing these two names over and over and over as people who he should seek out guidance from. And those two names were Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, and Rabbi Menachem Mendel Schneerson, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, the Lubavitcher Rebbe. So he describes the beginning of this book, how he went to 770, he was wandering around, he found someone, the closest guy, looked like he was a shtickle chabadnik. I can't say if that was based on his frock or the style of his beard or the crimped hat. But he said, you know, I'd like to meet the Rebbe. And the guy says, collapsed laughing. He says, what do you think? You can't just meet the Rebbe. There are thousands of people who are waiting for an audience with him. So Rabbi Sacks persisted, and he gave this chassid, he wrote down, he says, look, I'm traveling in America, I'm here from England, this is my story, and I really need to meet the Rebbe. So here's my number, I'm going to my aunt's house in Los Angeles. And if I have the opportunity, please, someone call me. And lo and behold, a few weeks later, the phone rings in his aunt's house in Los Angeles, that the Lubavitcher Rebbe is willing to meet him that Thursday night. I think it was like 12 o'clock at night, 1 o'clock in the morning. So Rabbi Sacks describes that he took a Greyhound bus from Los Angeles, California, to New York City. Can imagine. He said that's not the most highly recommended mode of transportation, but I guess as a college kid, he managed. And he describes meeting the Rebbe. And how the Rebbe began answering. He asked the questions. The Rebbe began answering all of his questions one at a time. And finally, at one point, the Rebbe changed the conversation. He switched the conversation. And instead of answering Rabbi Sacks' question, he started to ask Rabbi Sacks, who at that time was probably just known as Jonathan. He said, well, what are you doing on campus? How many Jews are there? What is the Jewish life like? How are you impacting people? And Rabbi Sacks started to, he said, he got very uncomfortable. And at one point, he used the phrase, he says, in the situation in which I find myself. And at that point, the Rebbe cut him off. And he said, you don't find yourself in any situation. You put yourself in a situation. And the Rebbe shared with him, he said, you put yourself in one. And, quote, if you put yourself in one situation, you can put yourself in another. The Rebbe challenged him to act. And he said that summer of 1968 changed his life. And part of this transformation was understanding the notion of being a leader, of taking a leadership role in whatever circle you find yourself. And what he said, and what I've heard him say in that video and other places, was the greatness, and what he writes here, the greatness of the Lubavitcher Rebbe was not that the Rebbe had tens of thousands of followers. Not that the Rebbe had followers. But what the Rebbe did was that the Rebbe created leaders. What I learned from him was that a good leader creates followers. A great leader creates leaders. And that's what Rabbi Sacks did. Rabbi Sacks was a great leader, and he encouraged us to be a leader. And he talks about in this volume how the Torah models for us and teaches us and guides us about leadership. And I'll share with you a brief piece from his introduction here called Daring Greatly. It was fascinating to discover how much of the Torah is, in fact, about leadership. Not in the narrow sense of holding formal office, but rather as a general approach to life. The heroes and heroines of the Torah, the patriarchs and matriarchs and their children, and the Israelites as they left Egypt and journeyed to the Promised Land, all were faced with the responsibilities of freedom. That, it seems to me, is the central drama of Judaism. So this is also a big Torah in Rabbi Sacks about responsibility, of course, leadership and responsibility, and Rav Rabinovich, I feel like it's somehow connected to each other. The ancient Greeks produced a monumental literature about character and fate, with larger-than-life heroes and often tragic outcomes. Ancient Israel produced a quite different literature about will and choice, with figures with whom we can identify, often battling with their own emotions against defeat and despair. The Torah offers us some dramatic and unexpected scenarios. It was not Noah, the righteous man, perfect in his generations, who became the role model for the religious life, but rather Avraham, who confronted God with some of the most audacious words in the history of faith. Shall the judge of all earth not do justice? Moshe, the hero of the Torah, of four of the five books of the Torah, is surely one of the most unexpected leaders of all time, inarticulate and tongue-tied at first, and utterly unconvinced of his capacity to fulfill the task to which God has summoned him. Each one of us can be a leader. Don't ever think, I'm skipping to the bottom, don't ever think that leaders are different from the rest of us. They aren't. We all need the courage to live with the challenges, the mistakes, and the mishaps, and to keep going. One of the truest as well as the most amusing remarks is the one attributed to Winston Churchill, which I heard Rabbi Sacks quote, and apparently he liked this. Success is going from failure to failure without a loss of enthusiasm. It is not their victories that make people leaders. It is the way they cope with their defeats, their ability to learn, to recover, and to grow. Rabbi Yaakov Tzvi, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, Yehi Zichro Baruch. Rabbi Sacks was the recipient of a prize not too many years ago, of a recognition of the Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb Prize at Yeshiva University. Rabbi Sacks actually delivered an acceptance speech. You can find it, I think, either on his website or on YouTube or certainly in YU's archives, of the tributes that Rabbi Sacks delivered for Rabbi Lamb. And this next figure, Harav Nachum Lamb, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, Dr. Lamb, is the next person who we will focus on, who we lost this past year. Rabbi Lamb grew up in Brooklyn. His grandfather, a great Chassidus Rav who had a tremendous influence on him, came into the world of the Rabbanus at a time where Orthodoxy was on the decline in the 1950s. And together with other, we mentioned a few weeks ago, Avi's father, Professor, where's the volumes here? Yeah, it's right there. Professor Marvin Fox, volumes on the shelf, and others, Rabbi Lamb led a renaissance of Orthodox Jewish life in the United States in the 50s and the 60s. He was a vocal spokesman on behalf of Torah Judaism, initiating tradition together with Rabbi Fox and other tons and tons of other projects, ultimately becoming the president of Yeshiva University after the passing of Dr. Belkin, Zecher Tzadik Levracha. When Dr. Belkin passed away, Rabbi Lamb was in the country. He was in Camp Morashah, and he stopped. He was on his way to New York to accept the presidency of YU. He stopped at the Kever to daven at the Kever of Dr. Belkin. And he saved the university, the yeshiva, from bankruptcy and ensured its financial success and became a preeminent spokesman for the tradition and the outlook, the Masorah, that embraces the broader world, a famous book that he wrote called Torah Umada, which is the slogan of YU, and that was a major theme that he wrote about and he built, and the Torah Umada Project, etc. He was an awesome and tremendous figure, but he was also a community rabbi, because in the 60s and 70s, after he was in several small communities initially, he became the rabbi of the Jewish Center, which became the pulpit, the stage, from which he delivered masterful drushos and did some of his incredible teaching. He was also an individual who cared about people. So despite the fact that he was an unusually exceptional, brilliant Jewish scholar, a PhD, and a noted author and speaker, but at the same time, he was also a rabbi, someone who was sensitive and cared about individual Jews. And one of the books I think I have, either I think in the introduction, they talk about how there was a girl in the Jewish Center whose parrot had died, and he wrote her a condolence letter of 3 pages to try to give her some chizuk, like a teenage girl. I saw an amazing story Years ago, Rabbi Lam visited, he was on a tour around the world visiting different Jewish communities. He ended up in India, and he met a young man there who, this young man, was a Bnei Akiva Madrich, but the family, they weren't particularly close to Yiddishkeit. And Rabbi Lam was so taken by this young man, this Bnei Akiva Madrich, that he offered to bring him to New York, all expenses paid, and to ensure that he would get a full scholarship at YU. Rabbi Lam spent a tremendous amount, just parenthetically, I know that some of the Rosh Yeshiva, after he passed away, noted this, tremendous amount of time making sure that there was finances available for all Talmidim to attend, you know, Yeshiva College, but specifically Reitz. I can tell you, I personally attended Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan and received Tzmicha at no charge. That was thanks to Dr. Lam, who is the signatory on my Ksav Tzmicha. So the son wanted to go, the Rabbi Lam offered this boy to come for free to YU, but the father, who is not religious, but he said, if my son is going to leave India, he's got to go to Israel. So what did Rabbi Lam do? He said, okay, if that's what's best for you. So he arranged that this boy should be able to go to yeshiva and to attend yeshiva in Israel. Ultimately, the entire family followed this boy to Israel. They made aliyah, and they all became observant. And that was just the consequence of Rabbi Lam taking time and effort out of his way to ensure education, a Torah education, for a total stranger, an Indian boy bringing an entire family to the embrace of Yiddishkeit, having nothing even to do with Yeshiva University. And one message that I take from Rabbi Lam is to build with words. Rabbi Lam built an institution, an empire of centrist orthodoxy, which is at the heart of so many communities around the world. He built that in Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan, in Yeshiva University, in Yeshiva College, and he did it with words. He built a philosophy that was compelling and true to the Our Masorah, was relevant in the modern age. He did it all with words. That's how he fundraised. That's why some few places in Chumash, when the Pasuk says Vayikach about a person, Rashi says, how did someone take someone, Vayikach, Bedvarim, with words. Rabbi Lam was a brilliant wordsmith, an incredible orator. I could still hear his cadence and the tone of his voice ringing in my ears from hearing him speak. I had the privilege when I was in the Wexner Kol HaElyon at Reitz to have monthly lunches with him and meetings with him. He challenged us to use words, with our pen, like the tradition articles that he wrote and the magazine that he founded, or the Torah Umara Project, but also to use our words as orators. And he referred to himself in this very, very fascinating and beautiful piece. He referred to himself as an unrepentant darshan. An unrepentant darshan. I'll share with you a few words from this essay. You see it on the screen. He was very close with Rav Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik, with the Rav. And so, in the context of talking about the importance of Drush, Rabbi Lam describes the Rav as a darshan. And is and this was a Drush model for himself. As the Rav is a darshan, as in all else, is in a class by himself. His use of language, including English, his facility in formulating profound ideas and clearly and cogently, his dramatic perorations, his creation of a sense of excitement and anticipation, the elegant architectonics of his addresses. You see Rabbi Lam's use of language is itself incredible. His almost theatrical flourishes at exactly the right time. All these are aspects of his virtuosity of techniques. But they are nothing, as nothing compared with his insistence upon the drasha as a medium for the teaching of ideas. He has essentially resurrected, in his own personal style, the medieval tradition of philosophical drush, geared to contemporary man. Because this essay, The Notes of an Unrepentant Darshan, Rabbi Lam is bemoaning the fact that in that time, he saw the downfall or the role of drush as being something that was denigrated, And he says, no, we need to resurrect that. For so many generations, it was so powerful and it's so impactful and it's necessary in our community. And he believes it'll come back. My desire to use him as a role model caused me no end of grief. Every time I heard him, I suffered genuine frustration, not only because his genius created a chasm which made imitation all but impossible, but also because he was able to use any and all sources without having to explain them in a most elementary manner. And because he was able to ignore that most tyrannical of all disciplines, the clock. The Rav did what none of us could afford to do. He luxuriated in his drushes, freely choosing his texts not only from Medrash and Agada and his classical exegetes, but also from Halacha and Kabbalah and everything. Next page. But this frustration was terribly important for me. I could not hope to duplicate what was sui generis. I was not speaking to an audience of elite Lomdim. I had to conform to the strictures of a limited service. But I could nay had to speak about real issues, real ideas, real concepts. I tried to learn from him to trust my listeners' intellectual capacities, if not their erudition, to impart to them a sense of excitement about ideas in general and Jewish teachings in particular, and to share with them the awareness of the pertinence of even the most abstract of concepts. That's what Drush needs to do, says Rabbi Lamb. Somehow I must learn the secret of this homiletic and rhetorical wizardry, by means of which the message I choose seemed both authentically Jewish, indeed necessary, and yet swam gracefully and freely with the greatest ideas and discoveries in the currents of Western man's mentality and culture. That's what we need to do, says Rabbi Lamb, to make sure that we can build a Torah world with words. Build it with words. Rav Nachum Lamb, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, Yehi Zichro Baruch. A man who actually knew Rabbi Lamb well, and yet criticized him and challenged him and critiqued him severely, was a Chicago personality who passed away this year, Rav Chaim Dov Keller, Zecher Tzadik Levracha. Rabbi Keller, who was a Telzer through and through, spent many years learning in Telz by Rabbi Bloch in Cleveland before coming to Chicago in 1961. But before he went to Telz Cleveland, he studied in Yeshivas Rabbi Yitzchak Kochanan. He went to Yeshiva College. He was a student of the Suvalka Rav of Reb David Lifshitz, Zecher Tzadik Levracha. I think Reb David was the one who encouraged him, one of the ones who encouraged him to go to Telz. When he left Telz for Chicago in 1961, beautiful Maisa, he left from Telz, and they had a little Sudas Preda, they had a little goodbye party for Rabbi Keller. So at the Sudas Preda, one of the Chavim spoke, and he talked about the Mesiras Nefesh of going to Chicago to found the Telz Yeshiva in Chicago. As he was wont to do, Rabbi Keller got up and gave a rejoinder. And he said, if I'd been leaving Yeshiva to go to work, that would be Mesiras Nefesh. I'm going to teach Torah. What more desirable thing is there to do? That is not Mesiras Nefesh. For Rabbi Keller, Torah was everything. And traditional Litvische Telzer learning was the world. He was appreciated greatly by his Talmidim, and he was well known, actually, in the broader Torah community because he was a frequent writer and contributor to the Jewish Observer, which was the Agudas magazine that was published for many years. I don't know exactly, maybe in the 90s it stopped publishing. But you can go online and you can search. The Aguda has the archives online, and there are many, many essays that are published for Rabbi Keller on all different kinds of topics. But what struck me the most as a message that I took away from Rabbi Keller about the importance for us of learning from this Torah giant who severely critiqued our Masorah, you know, and many of you know, I had the privilege and the personal honor and the great life gift of having a close relationship with Rav Avraham Chaim Levin, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, his brother-in-law, the Kol Rosh Yeshiva of Telz. I never had the opportunity to speak to Rabbi Keller. Rabbi Levin treated me with tremendous love and our Kol and our Masorah with tremendous respect. And Rabbi Keller spoke very, very harshly against the Hashkafa that he saw, broadly speaking, that characterized, and I don't use this term, and my Rabbeim don't, but I think, you know, he characterized it as modern orthodoxy, different personalities. And I take this as a tremendous Musar Haskel, and that is that Rabbi Keller encourages us, all people, to be passionate, to care, Don't be lethargic. If you have a Masorah, if you have a tradition, be stark about it. Be passionate about it. Don't just sit by. Be vigorous in your observance, in your adherence to your Hashkafas HaChaim, to your Masorah. So I'll share with you, I think you can see it online now. This is the Jewish Action Letter that he published. He called it a letter that should not have had to have been published. An extremely sharp letter that Rabbi Keller wrote to Dr. Lamb. And it was involving a period of time. This letter was published in 1995 regarding some issues regarding homosexuality and gay clubs in some of the graduate schools at YU, which I'm not getting into the whole details. And he describes at the beginning of the letter how he publishes this in the Jewish Observer only because Rabbi Lamb didn't respond to his personal letter, and he feels that there is such a Chil Hashem. One can no longer protest certain manifestations of Chil Hashem. Nonetheless, it's because of this Chil Hashem that he has to publish this letter publicly. And the letter is very sharp. Dr. Norman Lamb, President of Yeshiva University, I write this with a heavy heart. You must excuse the length of this letter, but I must share with you my extreme anguish. And I would hope that you will have the patience to read through these Dvarim HaYotzim and Halev. Remember, they overlapped in the 1950s in Yeshiva College. It's also interesting to note that Rabbi Keller, and you could tell this from reading many of his Jewish article pieces, was very familiar with what was going on in the world. He read many different periodicals, including Tradition and lots of other ones. He certainly didn't agree with them, and he vigorously debated them and criticized them, but he was certainly well-learned, which is also interesting and important to note. So he begins by quoting the story in the Jewish press about this gay club in Cardozo, which is the law school, a part of Yeshiva University. No sophistic semantic squirming will allow Yeshiva University to escape from the plain fact that the Lesbian and Gay Student Alliance of Cardozo is funded by the university in exactly the same manner as every other student group at the school through the Student Bar Association. Actually, whether the university funds or does not fund the clubs does not change the fact that their very existence on campus is an abomination. That they are officially funded by Yeshiva University only makes the Chil Hashem infinitely greater. Would any of the previous Rosh Yeshiva Zatzal of Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan condone such a policy? Have you consulted with your own present Rosh HaYeshiva? I cannot believe that one of them approves. You have retained legal counsel, etc. Going down to the next paragraph here, third column. It is not necessary for me to remind you of the decision of the Rosh Yeshiva Volozhin to let the yeshiva be closed in the face of the ultimatum of the Russian government to interfere in the affairs of the yeshiva in matters which were not of the severity of Yehorig V'al Yavar, which this Toeva is. What are your students to learn from your statement to the Jerusalem Post quoted in the commentator, the undergraduate newspaper of Yeshiva College? As a rabbi, I cannot and do not condone homosexual behavior, but as president of a non-denominational institution, it is my duty to ensure that the policies and procedures of Yeshiva University conform to the applicable provisions of secular law, etc. Last paragraph that we're going to share here. The lesson is simple. The Torah component of Torah Mada is expendable when it conflicts with secular law governing the non-denominational mode of Mada dispensed at Yeshiva University. This flies in the face of all the pious pronouncements in your published manifesto, Torah Umada, which Rabbi Keller did read. This is important, Mussar Haskel, for all of us. Because, A, when we see something, we should read it. Because you can't disagree with something without reading it. B, you should reach out to the person personally. And C, we should be passionate. We should be passionate. It doesn't mean that we should be publishing harsh manifestos in newspapers. That's subject of discussion. But I would say I learned from Rabbi Keller the importance of being passionate. We spoke about the Novominsker, Rav Rabinovich, Rabbi Sachs, Dr. Lamb, Rabbi Keller. Rabbi Keller, Yizichro Baruch, of course, we're running late on time. So we're going to move to our last five personalities. Another Rosh Yeshiva from the Torah world who left us just recently, but who had the exact opposite use of words from Rabbi Keller, who was a common expositor of ideas in writing and in speech, was the late Rosh Yeshiva and the Siftat Tiferes Yerushalayim, Rav David Feinstein, Zecher Tzadik Levracha. Rav David Feinstein actually wrote very little, and I would say, let me say it like this. A few weeks ago, I had the opportunity as one of a group of Rabbanim to participate in a special program from Machon Pua, which deals with questions of infertility and halacha. So we had the guest presentation, the guest shiur that we were privileged to have. Our Rabbanim was with Rav David Cohn, Shalita of Brooklyn, the great posik from Gvul Yavetz. So Rav David Cohn began with a couple of words talking about Rav David Feinstein, about how Rav David would sit at meetings and would be so quiet because he chose his words so carefully. It's interesting that even though he chose his words so carefully, he was one of the most important and influential believers in sharing the word of Torah with a contemporary audience. And how was that? It was through Art Scroll. If you open up any Art Scroll volume, you'll find at the top, Board of Trustees, Rabbi David Feinstein, Rosh HaYeshiva, Misefta Teferis Yerushalayim. It's an unbelievable maisa, incredible, incredible maisa, that when Art Scroll was struggling, the founders of Art Scroll, Rabbi Meir Zlatowitz, Zichrono Levracha, and Lahavdil Ben Chaim Ben Chaim, Rabbi Nosson Sherman, they mortgaged their own homes to be able to fund the continuing operations of Masorah Publications and Art Scroll. And they were really on the verge of closing their doors. And Reb David learned about this, and he took his life savings and gave it to them to publish Art Scroll. His personal life savings was given to Art Scroll. Why? To ensure that the word of Torah would be disseminated as widely as possible among the English-speaking public. Not too long ago, before his patir, actually, I think it was last year or 2 years ago, there's a beautiful video of him, of Rav David Feinstein, Zichrono Levracha, touring the new Art Scroll publishing facility. Now, of course, Art Scroll and the Masorah Publications, they are a titan in the publishing world, and they are singularly responsible for opening the doors of Torah and every aspect of Torah learning to the general English-speaking public. And yet, at their head was a man of very few words. Choose your words wisely. And I think one Torah that captures this, if you look at the end of the Parsha in the Art Scroll Chumash, I don't know how many people ever noticed this, there is a little mnemonic, a Masoretic note, at the end of the Parsha, that notes how many psukim are in this Parsha. So for example, this week's Parsha is Parshas Vayechi, there are Pei Hei Psukim. So the Masoretic note, to remind you of how many psukim, is Peh El Peh, mouth to mouth, speaking one mouth to another mouth. And every pasuk, every parsha, concludes with a simen of the number of those psukim. Well, if you look in the Art Scroll Chumash, Rav David Feinstein has a little comment explaining that those Masoretic notes, those little tiny words. He says that this number 85 relates the word peh. This alludes to the theme of our Sedra in which Yaakov spoke to his children, relating to them the blessings that would form the core of their mission for all time. In the mnemonic of our Sedra, Rav David Feinstein, who interprets these Masoretic notes, finds support for his contention that they are meant not only as a convenient memory devices, but to encapsulate the message of the Sedra. If nothing were intended except a reminder that there are 85 verses, it would have been sufficient to use only the word peh, mouth, or po, here. But this would tell us nothing about the Sedra itself. Therefore, it was expanded to peh el peh, mouth to mouth. Rav David Feinstein taught us in his life that just a tiny mnemonic can capture a lot of ideas, many things that need to be communicated. It's not lengthy essays, although he did write a few books, but those books were in English. He wrote a Haggadah, he wrote about the Jewish calendar. Even though his late father, the great Rav Moshe Feinstein, the Posek Hador, said about his son, he knows everything that is in Shas. Rav David Feinstein, he grew up in Soviet Russia until he was 8 or 10 years old. He became the Rosh Yeshiva Masifta Teferis Yerushalayim. He was such a humble man. Every day he ate breakfast in the same little pizza shop. He didn't eat in the yeshiva cafeteria because his original agreement 55 years ago was that his salary did not include, his meager salary didn't include breakfast in the yeshiva. And you could reach him by the payphone. You know, there's so many beautiful stories I could share with you if you want to email me afterwards. But one thing, one message that I took away from Rav David Feinstein, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, is the importance of choose your words. Yehi Zichro Baruch. Another man of words, maybe one of the most influential wordsmiths of an entire century, who we lost this year, was Rav Adin Evan Yisrael, Rav Adin Steinsaltz, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. Rav Adin Steinsaltz, he wrote the first comprehensive commentary on the Gemara for the learner in 900 plus years since the days of Rashi. It was controversial to reset the Tzuras Hadaf, but you know what? Even before Art Scroll came along to make the Torah accessible to the modern individual, if you want to talk about somebody who, similar to Reb David, Zichrono Livracha, believed in making the word of Torah accessible to the common man, the average individual learner, and then, of course, to all human beings, it would be Rav Steinsaltz. Rav Steinsaltz, by the way, wrote dozens of books on every possible topic you could imagine, on Tanya, on literature, and of course, on translating the Talmud. Rav Steinsaltz's goal was to be an accompaniment to your learning. So when I was growing up, before they had Art Scroll, when I was a kid, if the average balabas wanted to have access to a Gemara, they had to look into Steinsaltz. Now, of course, people criticized it, that it's cheapening the limud, but that was true if you were supposed to be sitting in a base medrash learning for 3 hours of morning seder and breaking your head so you could get to the depths of the Gemara on your own through Hasmada and Limud. But for the average person for whom the Talmud was a completely closed book, how did they have access? They only had access through Steinsaltz. Rabbi Steinsaltz's monumental work. It's mind-blowing to think. And this was a project that took him 45 years. It ended up winning him the Israel Prize. If you look at the scope of his works, what he taught, it's absolutely mind-blowing. It's mind-blowing. And yet, he too was a person who related to every individual. There's an entire book written by an author about the stories, the vignettes of Rabbi Steinsaltz driving to different places. This was a guy who drove Rabbi Steinsaltz from one place to another, and the interactions that he had with people. There's a woman named Yehudit Shabta, who's an editor at Translating the Steinsaltz Center. Of course, Rabbi Steinsaltz, you know, was the head of many institutions, educational institutions that you're familiar with, including the high school Makor Chaim, including, you know, he was the youngest principal in the history of the state of Israel. His parents were not religious. He became a Baal Tshuva. She tells the following story, this woman. When our daughter was 1 year old, we brought her to the Rav, to Rav Steinsaltz for a bracha. He said to the child, "I bless you that your parents will not get in the way of your growth." Because through all of Rav Steinsaltz's activities and teachings and learning and institutions, he was a nonconformist. And he told us not to conform just for the sake of conforming. If there is a Torah need, if there is a L'shem Shamayim project that must be had, don't conform. Just because other people don't run a high school like that, doesn't mean that you shouldn't. Just because other people don't publish a translation of the Talmud like that, doesn't mean that you shouldn't. Don't conform for the sake of conforming. Rav Steinsaltz became a Baal Tshuva, highly connected to the Lubavitch movement. And yet, he didn't conform to all of the Lubavitch Mahalach HaChaim. He was a close confidant of the Rebbe. His son describes how he was once walking on Eastern Parkway, in Crown Heights, I think it was on Eastern Parkway, and his son asked if they were going to see the Rebbe, and he said he wasn't ready yet. But the Rebbe happened to come out and was walking, and he motioned that Rav Steinsaltz should come over, and they conversed for a few minutes. They were mamish close. They were mamish close. But he didn't consider himself constricted by the limitations of Chabad, of a particular movement. It was all about what was his vision and his understanding of Torah Chaim, of Makor Chaim, of how to bring the Torah to life. And even if that meant doing things and teaching things and exploring things that seemed to other people as contradictory, to be out there in the world, even in a way that other people wouldn't understand because it was so complex and nuanced and challenging. And therefore, he wrote a book called Pebbles of Wisdom, which captures one idea that I thought is so important for us to understand about paradoxes, because in many ways, he was, in a certain sense, a paradox. Was he a part of this community, or was he a part of that community? Was he Israeli, or was he American? Was he global? Was he local? The answer was, he was all of these things. But just because it's a paradox doesn't mean that it can't be. And this relates to a beautiful, deep idea that he shared about emuna. That one can ask, he says, quote, one can ask all kinds of questions without those questions undermining one's faith. I was once a student of mathematics. I know about so many unanswered problems and so many paradoxes and so many logical contradictions in mathematics. Do these things undermine my belief or understanding of mathematics? Not at all. You don't have to conform to be a believer. You could be a nonconformist. Follow your path. Yehi Zichro Baruch, Rav Adin Steinsaltz. Another Israeli figure who was a tremendous influence, but not in the same way as Rav Steinsaltz, in the sense that Rav Steinsaltz was known around the world. He was interviewed on CBS and on every possible medium. This man, for many people in this call, will probably be anonymous, unknown to many of you. He grew up, he lived till the age of 10 in Belarus, came to Israel, studying some of the greatest yeshivas, the Chevron Yeshiva, the Ponovich Yeshiva, and he was recognized as one of the Torah luminaries of the entire 20th century, certainly the later half of the 20th century, by the greatest Chachmei HaMasorah. He was identified and soon became the son-in-law of the late Gaon, the Tzaddik, the Rosh Yeshiva, the great Gadol Hador of Shlomo Zalman Orbach, Zichrono Levracha, and his name was Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg. Rav Zalman Nechemia was an unusual halachic expert, because on the one hand, he lived in the Shikun Chabad neighborhood of Yerushalayim, where I had the privilege of being in his house once. He lived in the Dalet Amos of Halacha and was immersed in the details, in the lumdus of technical halachic problems. He was an Av Bezna, he was a member of the Bezna HaGadol of the State of Israel's rabbinic court for many, many years. And yet, his quiet reach influenced far beyond his Dalet Amos of Halacha. Not just because his Piskei Halacha were renowned all around the world, and when the RCA needed to put together a prenuptial agreement to combat the problem of agunas, his imprimatur, his haskama, was one of the most significant and substantive steps in making that a reality. Not just that, but because he was accessible to all schools of learning throughout Israel. This man, who, if you only knew him by halachic writings, you would not know how broad he was in terms of his connections to people. I had the great privilege, between the years 1997 and 1999, to study in Yeshivat Keren B'Yavne. I was a little pisher. I was a 16-year-old kid who came to Israel, who was in a yeshiva that was way, way, way greater than I could even understand. And you know, a man showed up to this yeshiva every week to give a shiur, not in the Beis Medrash building, in the next building over. This man came with a big, circular black round hat and a kapata and a friendly beard, and he sat down every week in the same spot in this small mini Beis Medrash with a cup of tea and a beautiful radiant smile on his face behind his white beard. This man was Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg. And every single week, he would travel from Yerushalayim to Keren B'Yavne, a Hesder Yeshiva. He would go to Shalavim. He would go anywhere and everywhere to teach Torah. The man knew no political boundaries. He knew no hang-ups, no machloksim, no issues. All he knew was Torah. All he knew was lumdus, was halacha. So I went. Do you think I remember what he taught? I have notebooks. Do you think I understood what he was really saying then? I was a kid. What did I understand? Every shiur was brilliant lumda, so there was tremendous clarity. And then when I went back, Nechama and I, we had the opportunity to learn in the Grus Kola when we were first married. So at that time, he was still giving weekly shiurim also in Machon Lev. So I used to go on Tuesday mornings. I used to walk next door for his shiurim. Any possible topic. You know, sometimes he would walk in and he would say to people, well, what masechta are you learning? And he would just give a complex, deep, deep, deep halachic analysis. But he was accessible to everyone. He didn't know political divisions or hashkafic divisions. He lived in the world of halacha exclusively. And because of that, he didn't see any differences between Jews. We were all Talmidim. And so he was accessible to everyone. Rabbi Reis tells unbelievable mice that when he was younger, when he just started out at the Beis Din of America, they had a very difficult shaila about a particular get that had a lot of questions about it because of the signatory about the Edim. So Rabbi Reis and the Rabbonim in the RCA Beis Din, at that time, of course, Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, will come back to it as the last person. Rabbi Reis had this very difficult question, halachic conundrum. He wrote it up. He sent a 7-page fax to the phone number that he was given to send it to this gadol in Eretz Yisrael, in Yerushalayim HaKodesh, Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg. He said, the next day, within 24 hours, he received a personal phone call from Rav Zalman Nechemia going through the exact shaila and answering it to explain why the get was fine. Because Rav Zalman Nechemia, from the lens of halacha, it doesn't matter what Beis Din you're on, it doesn't matter what Hashkafas Chaim you are, halacha is halacha. In those years, he came and he gave shiurim in the yeshivas. There were a couple of older guys, two senior avreichim when I was a kid. So these alter bachrim in Kerem B'Yavne, there were two nesanals. One was Netanel Berkovich and Nesanel Tzipel. We only called them by their last names, Tzipel and Berkovich. So they were Talmidim Mufakim of Rav Zalman Nechemia, and his acronym was the Gon Rav Zalman Nechemia. So we called him the Garzin. Garzin means a hammer. He was so soft, I don't know why we called him, the nickname, him the hammer, the Garzin, but that was his Ragon Rav Zalman Nechemia. So the Garzin gave every week and give a shiur, so they published a series of shiurim, Ginzei Shiurim. I have another set of sefer of his called Ora Moadim, several svarim. But he encouraged us to think deeply in halacha. To think deeply, because if you really want to answer a shaila, if you really want to solve a din Torah, if you really want to understand a sugya, you have to think deeply. You have to know the lumdus, the pilpul, the words of the achronim, the later commentaries. I still remember one shtickle Torah, my favorite shtickle Torah that I ever heard from him, the one shtickle Torah that I just always remember, Baal Peh, when I went to prepare for this and I opened up my sefer, Ginzei HaTorah, I found this, you recognize these kinds, this shape of paper? Any of you ever learned in Israel? Any of you have those Israeli notebooks? So I found this notes. I don't even know what year this is from. If this is from Kerem B'Yavne or if this is from Machon Lev or some other visit that I had where it's amazing shtickel Torah to be Miyashiv Akasha and Rabbi Kiva Eger in Hilchos Shofar. Rav Zalman Nechemia explained a fundamental principle of Lechatchila and Bidiyevid. There are different kinds of Lechatchila and Bidiyevid. Lechatchila is most preferred, ideal. Bidiyevid is Shasatchak, what can you do after the fact, post facto? So Lechatchila is one thing, b'diavad is another thing. How do you have l'chatchil and b'diavad? What does that even mean? So we explained that in your day you can have l'chatchil and b'diavad. You can have ideal and not ideal because you can have multiple opinions. You want to fulfill 6 opinions in the Rishonim? That's l'chatchil. B'diavad, you have one to rely on? Okay. But that's only one kind of l'chatchil and b'diavad. He said in other areas of halacha, you have to think about it differently. He said when something is a matir, when he quoted a tosus, Rav Schechter also likes to quote this tosus, when something is a matir, then you have no possibility of lechatchila b'dievet. There are certain things like a mikvah. A mikvah is either kosher or it's not kosher. If you want to fulfill certain opinions, but the idea of tevila either it is or it isn't. The totsah. As opposed to, he explained to us, that there is a third category, right? There are lechatchila b'dievets in Yoredeya and trying to fulfill multiple shitas. There's something whether you're tahor or tome tevila is kosher or not. And then there's lechatchila b'dievet and mitzvos. So for example, in this context, he was talking about the mitzvah of Kriya Shema. That lechatchila, when you say Shema, you should hear it. B'dievet, if you didn't hear it, Karav lo shmeli ozno, different opinions. The Gemara, we paskin, b'dieved yur yotzi. So he explained that to us conceptually to understand that really there are two mitzvahs in Shema. It's not that it's one mitzvah with two layers. It's that there are two mitzvahs. There's the mitzvah of reading the Shema, and there's the mitzvah of hearing the Shema. Reading and hearing, not the same mitzvah. And therefore, we have to figure out which of these components is essential, is indispensable. So, in the case of Kriya Shema, only the reading, the Kriya, is ma'akev, but the Shmiya is not ma'akev, but they're two different mitzvos. Let's say the Nafka Mina over there is a case of somebody who can speak but cannot hear. They are medaber ve'eno shomea. So they could say the Shema, but they can't hear it. But if the essential mitzvah of Shema is the Kriya, so then you can be Yotze. The same way that somebody who is medaber ve'eno shomea is not a cheresh fully, and therefore they can be Yotze b'dieved, they can be motzi somebody, they can be Yotze berchas hamazon and tefillah, as opposed to answering Rabbi Kiveger's kasha, not for today, it's way too long and it's getting late, about the mitzvah of shofar. That somebody who is a medaber ve'eno shomea, Rabbi Kiveger holds that the mitzvah, the ikar mitzvah is the shmiya, so then that's totally ma'akiv. But the lumdus of it, what was so brilliant, first of all, his shiurim was so clear, even a little kid like me could understand the sequence of the shiurim. But what he was trying to understand was that the halacha is based on principles, on concepts, and you have to think deeply about those concepts to understand them so that you can apply them. Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg, Mori Varabi, Yizichro Baruch. Finally, our last two figures. Still in the Israeli scene, this year we lost the former chief Sephardic rabbi, the Rishon LeZion, Rav Elio Bakshi Doron, Zecher Tzadik Levracha. It was interesting to hear about him. I didn't know very much about him, but hear about him from a man who also didn't know much about him, but ended up working very closely with him, a figure who many of us are familiar with, Rav Yisrael Meir Lau Shlita. Rav Lau says that when they became chief rabbis together, I think it was 1993, that Rav Lau became the Ashkenazi chief rabbi and Rav Bakshi Doron became the Sephardic chief rabbi. He says they came from totally different backgrounds. They had never spoken to each other before. And he said despite the chasm of difference between them, they had a shared language and they got along so beautifully. He said we served for 10 years together. And because of his havana, his wisdom, his insight, his pikchus, his sharpness, they were able to maintain a sense of unity despite their differences. And Rav Bakshi Doron, he was somebody who was truly focusing on serving Klal Yisrael and the Klal Yisrael institutions. He himself was recognized as a tremendous halachic Talmud Chacham, as a young avreich studying the Porat Yosef. I think he was 25 when he became the chief rabbi of Bat Yam. I think he was 45 when he became the chief rabbi of Haifa. And he was acknowledged as a great goyim by his senior contemporary, Rabbi Vad Yosef, Zecher Tzadik Levracha. He had many different activities when he was the chief rabbi, specifically focused on the institution of the Rabbanut and the State of Israel as an institution for serving Klal Yisrael. And that meant making sure that Gior was done correctly. That meant making sure that the institutions of the Rabbanus were done correctly, even if it meant some controversy. So there is a Shtickel Torah that he has published, which is really interesting and controversial, caused a lot of consternation, that was published here in this volume of Tchumen, Tchumen 25, Chok Nisuin V'Gerushin, Hayatza Schar B'Hafsedo. Rav Bakshi Doron challenges the status quo. And in this context, this was published in Tuf, when was this, 25 years? This was Tuf Shin Samach Hey. Tuf Shin Samach Hey. This is 2 years after he stepped down as the chief, the Sephardic chief rabbi. Rav Bakshi Doron challenges the State of Israel's law that all of marriage and divorce should be governed by the Rabbanut, by the Jewish courts, by Halacha. What? The chief rabbi arguing that you should offer an alternative to Halachic marriage? He said yes. Because he says, I worry about Klal Yisrael. I worry about the state of Israel. I worry about the state of the Jewish people. And what I see, says Rachmana Litzlan, is that unfortunately, even though when the state of Israel was founded, there were more Jews who were halachically inclined. They were traditional. They understood the role of halacha in a Jewish life. But now, unfortunately, over the course of years, many people in the state of Israel, a large majority of the people, are not interested in following a Torah lifestyle. And not only that, they are running away to Cyprus to get married civilly, and then they come back and they're recognized from these marriages outside. And basically, this law, which is meant to protect the family, the Jewish tradition, and something that we're talking about in our weekly shiur, the whole infrastructure of the Jewish identity in the state of Israel, he says, and he writes this 15 years ago, is being undermined. It's being undermined by the reality of the secular practices that are going on across the state of Israel. So he says, so what do people do sometimes? They say, well, you have a couple, and he says, unfortunately, he knows this in many cases of people who are not observant. They're not other b'torah v'mitzvos. When they get married, they have no intention of living a monogamous lifestyle, and they know that the wife is going to sometimes, you know, find her own relationships, even while they're married. There's going to be a problem. Eishesish, Amam Zerim. So he says, what are we doing? Yotza Schar Bev Seido. He challenges us in this halachic work, which is part halachic, but part, you know, a Torah perspective musing, asking us to consider what have we done to help these people if they're going to be halachically married, but they're not going to be faithful to each other. So have we done a service or a disservice? He says, so what do some rabbis do? He says, they establish, you know what they do? And he says, he's seen some rabbis and he's talked to rabbis who do this. They do a wedding that's registered as the Rabbanut, as a wedding, with quote-unquote chuppah v'kiddushin, with pasul edim. So that the wedding actually is not kosher and that the couple is never really married. So don't worry, if the wife has an affair and she has children, then there won't be mamzerim. But he says, that's not acceptable. That's not okay on many levels. Kneva Stas, you tell these people they're doing a wedding and you're not doing a wedding? Second of all, who says that being miyachad edim sulam even works? Maybe there are other edim there, so it's a machlokas poskim, so he quotes that. He quotes many sources, tremendous Talmud Chacham. He says, what about if they are chozer b'tshuva? What if they come back b'tshuva? What if they never knew about it and they wanted to have a chuppah v'kiddushin, or they changed their mind later on? What about a bracha levatala for the rav who's misader kiddushin? He says, you have to go through all these different things. What about Kiddushin, but the fact that the people are not interested in Kiddushin? He goes back and forth. What about the fact that some of these secular people are not interested in getting married at all, and they actually reject the whole premise of the Maisa Kiddushin that's being done? So he says, when I think of these things, I think of the Gemari quotes in the Divrei Chazal and Enem Maseches Brachos. He quotes a story from Hillel, trying to understand the situation of the generation. He writes, Mavurash afal pisha borash Talmud Torah keneged kulam. Obviously, Talmud Torah is keneged kulam. Umitzvah rabba lulmo Torah. And lalami Torah, to teach Torah. But if you see shador she'ena Torah chavivalov, look at the secular public in Israel, you have to yesh l'schashiv b'matsui v'lo b'ratsui. You have to deal with the reality, not with the ideal, not with what is desirable. Lo rak she'en to'eles, not only is there no purpose in coercing these people to observe Torah, but there's also a bizayon haTorah. And therefore, in quite a controversial stand, he actually argued that perhaps it's beneficial to create an alternative to marriage in Israel, and you can call it something else, and there's a follow-up conversation in the end of this piece, but it was all from the sense of serving Klal Yisrael. And finally, coming back to Chicago, and it's 10:30, I know we're out of time, so we'll just mention him very briefly, because I spoke about Mori Varabi, Martin Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz, Zecher Tzadik Levracha, at great length last week, or not at great length, Al Regalachas last week. But Rav Schwartz, he too was caring about Klal Yisrael, and one of the main messages that I took from all the times that I had meeting with him weekly for so many months, years, B'siyata D'Shemaya, what a gift. Rav Schwartz taught me and taught us to transmit the Masorah. In one of the last public talks that Rav Schwartz gave, he had a group, we were there meeting with him. We met with him right before Pesach, Rachav Yakolo, in 2016, before Pesach and right after Pesach, he had his stroke right in the middle of his Daf Yomi Shir, for those who remember, in May. So right before Pesach, he taught us about a Belzer Minug, that before they start Manashana, they clap. The Shoel claps. Every person, I don't know how many people know this, the Belzer Minug, that before you say the Manashana, you clap your hands. So Rav Schwartz wanted to explain to us, why is it that a person claps their hands before asking the Manashtana? So he says he thought that maybe the pshat is that the entire purpose of the Seder, the whole V'higadot Labincha, is to remember that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God, He gave us the Torah from His hand to the hand of Moshe Rabbeinu, one hand to the other. He said he wanted to explain, he was Mosif, that the Masorah, the tradition that we receive from our parents, our grandparents, our teachers, our Rabbein, the Gedolei Hador, the Gaone Olam, is a Masorah which is passed on from one hand to another. It is Miyad Liyad, and he connected that to the idea of Kinyan Mesira, the Kinyan of Torah, acquiring Torah, which is passed on, it's a transmission, which is through Kinyan of Mesira, Moser, to hand over. How are you Moser? Miyad Liyad, from one hand to another. Mishchu ukhu lochem. Mishchu, you want to do a Kinyan Meshicha on the Korban Pesach and on the fundamentals of Yadus? It's got to be Miyad Liyad, from one hand to another. It's got to be the tradition, the Masorah. And that's why he explained, he told over the Maisa, when he was recognized by Ritz at the Chag HaSmicha before his passing, he recognized that that's why he came to Yeshivas Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan in the first place, because of a connection to Masorah, because his father, who was a European Jew, said, oh, there is the yeshiva where the Enikel of Rav Chaim Soloveitchik is teaching, Rav Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik, I want my son to go there. That's what Rav Schwartz said. His whole life was a teaching of Masorah, of Yad Liyad, Yehi Zichro Baruch. So today we remembered these incredible Torah luminaries who we lost during this period of 2020. We remember the Novominska Rebbe, Zichrono Livracha, who challenged us, who charged us, who called upon us to love Jews. We met Rav Nachum Rabinovich, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, who called upon us, he taught us, he challenged us to take responsibility, to own our free choice. We met, we re-encountered, we embraced Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks, who taught us, he reminded us to be a leader in our own life. We embraced, we remembered, we connected with Rabbi Dr. Lamb, Zichrono Livracha, who modeled for us how to build with words, build a family, build an institution, build a community, build a movement with words, the unrepentant darshan, Yehi Zichro Baruch. We met Rav Chaim Dov Keller, Zichrono Livracha, who taught us to be passionate, to be fired up, to believe stridently in your tradition. Be passionate about what you believe in. Use your words with passion. And we met, we embraced, we were humbled by the presence of Rav David Feinstein, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, who taught us by example of how to choose our words carefully, sparingly, be choice with our words so that they will be heard in that way, in that effective way. But make sure that those words, the words of Torah, reach the broadest possible audience. As we met Rav Steinsaltz, who spent his life laboring to educate every single person who could possibly be reached in some method through Torah, and who taught us not to conform, that to spread the voice of Torah, the word of Torah, beyond, it means breaking down barriers, and don't conform, don't be limited. Similar to the personality, the ge'onus, the halachic expertise and insight of Rav Zalman Chemi Goldberg, who too was not limited by community boundaries, but encouraged all of his Talmidim, all of us in any possible yeshiva, to think deeply, to learn deeply, to analyze deeply. We understood that Rav Bakshi Doron, Zichrono Livracha, was encouraging us to serve Klal Yisrael, to think about Klal Yisrael, to understand the importance of the Klal Yisrael institutions. And finally, Moreinu of Rabbeinu Rav Gedalia Dov Schwartz, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, to transmit the Masorah, to learn these lessons from these great Gedolim who are connected to previous generations, whether those previous generations were in the world of Sfard or Eastern Europe, whether they were Chassidish or Litvish. We, as a student, as students of Torah, as a community of Torah, we look to all of them to broaden, deepen, and enrich our individual Torah personalities, as their Talmidim, as people who are living during this time, we must take this opportunity to reflect and appreciate these and all of the lessons that we can learn from these Torah personalities that we have lost during this difficult Kufa of 2020. May their neshamas be a Melitz Yosher for all of us. May they entreat through Ribbono Shel Olam to bring a Yeshua, a refuah, and a geula, so that we should celebrate together in person Torah simchas and values that we can live together with the redemption, with happiness, the mehera v'yameinu, with the coming Mashiach. We should all be back in Eretz Yisrael, b'geula hashleima, b'mehera v'yameinu. Amen v'amen.